In the world of copyright, the public domain can often seem to lie just beyond the horizon, like a mirage in the desert or the famed golden city of El Dorado. If a traveler should manage to reach it, there is no return journey possible. Welcome to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Beyond the Book. The legal definition of public domain is property that is available or accessible to the public, such as a national park. In copyright, PD refers to inventions, writings, recordings, or photographs that are not protected by intellectual property law. Earlier this week, we learned that when it comes to JD, the PD is not always clear. Andrew Albanese, Publishers Weekly senior writer, joins me now from New York to explain. And welcome back to Beyond the Book, Andrew.
Hey there, Chris.
So what's with all the alphabet soup, JD and PD? We have a lawsuit here by a small reprint publisher against the estate of JD Salinger. Tell us more.
Yeah, a fascinating case, sort of having to do with the PD, the public domain, filed by Memphis-based independent publisher, the DeVoe Graves Agency. They filed suit in a federal court against the J.D. Salinger Literary Trust, claiming that the estate has illegally interfered with and thwarted the press's attempts to publish and distribute international editions of its collection of early J.D. Salinger stories called Three Early Stories. My colleague Claire Swanson reported on this story this week. DeVoe Graves released their U.S. edition of these early Salinger stories as they fell into the public domain in July of 2014. And notably, the Salinger estate does not object to that publication. They acknowledge that in the U.S., those stories are indeed in the public domain. But as the publisher has attempted to sell the work abroad, the Salinger estate has been threatening lawsuits, arguing that even though the stories are in the public domain in the United States, they are not in the public domain in other territories. Interesting, and they may indeed have a point. But I've been speaking with attorneys and other experts on this subject all week, and you can read my report next week on the PW website. And as one attorney described to me today, it's an absolute circus of a case. You know, I'll just tell you what's interesting to me, that this is yet another example of an independent suing a literary estate, and it recalls Les Klinger's successful suit against the Arthur Conan Doyle estate, which recently concluded by affirming that all but 10 Sherlock Holmes stories are in the public domain. But of course, there are a few different elements here. And the most interesting element to me, different from the Klinger suit, is that in the Klinger suit, the Doyle estate was said to be demanding payments for uses of Sherlock Holmes, even though the works were in the public domain. But in the Salinger case, the estate really does not want the material published at all. And what I find funny about that is that you're going to concede publication in the largest territory, the United States, of these works, and then you're going to fight to keep them from being unpublished in Bulgaria. 500 Bulgarian readers can't read this stuff. All of which sort of underscores to me the real need for some sort of harmonization of the public domain internationally. And you can look at it this way, you know, why should readers in the U.S. be able to read these stories while readers in other territories may not be able to get them until as late as 2060 if the Salinger estate is correct about when the copyrights expire? And I think maybe there's a deeper unreconciled issue more fundamentally in copyright, and that's about moral rights. In the U.S., the Copyright Act espouses the advancement of arts and culture. There's a public component to copyright here, and that's not so in a lot of European countries that allow for moral rights, which, of course, gives authors and their estates the ability to control whether their works are available at all. So, you know, the specific legal case aside here, and there's some interesting twists in that that I'm going to be reporting on, and you can check out that piece next week. I think that this court fight says a lot about the state of the international public domain.
Well, you know, Andrew, if I've said it once, I've said it 100 times. When it comes to copyright, if you're confused, you're beginning to understand the problem.
Absolutely.
Anyway, well, we have another key copyright case that you've been following for some time now, the Georgia State e-reserves case. And this week, we heard from GSU itself, Georgia State University, on the publisher's recent motion to create a new record going forward. They say, no thanks very much. So tell us about that.
That's right. You know, a very interesting development in this closely watched case about library e-reserves and digital course readings on campus. Our listeners will remember that this case, the Georgia State case, was actually reversed on appeal and remanded to the district court. And now the publisher plaintiffs in the case have asked that the record be reopened and that new evidence from the most recent academic terms be used to determine whether Georgia State's policies on digitized course reading infringing. But as you say, GSU attorneys have filed a motion opposing that idea. And I think they sort of, you know, correctly point out that the point of the remand, at least as I read the decision from the 11th Circuit, was for her to revise her legal analysis of certain fair use issues. And as GSU attorneys say, not to rectify a purportedly incomplete or inadequate factual record. In their filing, the publishers argue that they need this new evidence because if the judge is to fashion an appropriate injunction to address ongoing infringement, well, they'll need to see exactly what those practices are. But as observers have told me, the publishers also appear to be angling for a second bite at the apple in this case, possibly because they mishandled their first shot. As we've discussed here on this podcast before, of the 99 counts of alleged infringement in this case that were presented for trial, only 48 actually got to a fair use analysis. Many of them were knocked out by technicalities and record-keeping issues, and for 33 of the works in question, digital licenses were not available at the time, a fact that weighed pretty heavily against infringement in Evans's fair use analysis, but that would almost certainly not be the case today, 5 or 6 years later. So just a little quick analysis on a point that I think could pose a problem, and that's that, you know, the appeals court also struck down the bright lines that Evans had suggested in her filing. She had suggested that, you know, a chapter of a work, for example, would be an acceptable fair use. So if they were to gather new evidence, would GSU be punished for following the guidance that the judge erroneously offered in her first ruling? Maybe, maybe not. But it's at least worth noting that even though the appeals court said you can't codify those bright lines, obviously, Judge Evans thought at some point that those bright lines were reasonable. So maybe she would find that that was okay. But what really stood out to me in this filing this time around, the GSU filing, was the disclosure that GSU had suggested that there be a stay in the case after it instituted a revised copyright policy in 2009. They pitched it as sort of a cooling off period so everyone could see how the policy was working before they decided to proceed with the suit. And the publishers, of course, so the GSU says, declined that. And now GSU is throwing that back right in their faces. You know, having elected to proceed, the publishers should not now be heard to complain of the record they insisted on presenting, they argue. And they say that after all of this work and this huge trial and all the analysis, that the evidence should not be a dry run for the plaintiffs to have a second go at whole new allegations of infringement. So we'll see what Judge Evans has to say on this. You know, I think I would tend to agree with GSU that opening the record would essentially mean a whole new case here. And if that's what we're after, then just file a new case. You know, go through the discovery, go through it all again. But I don't see how reopening the record here really works. And if I'm Judge Evans, I would probably resist attempts to allow this case, which has been going on for 5 or 6 years now, to sprawl any further. I'd just let the appeals court sort that out again. Hey, that's just me.
Well, we'll see where that all leads us. But, you know, we certainly can say reliably that the lawyers have been busy this week in court as well as in the boardroom, because we've had a blockbuster deal, one that I'm sure the lawyers worked on for many a long night. Library vendor Overdrive was acquired by Rakuten, the Japanese e-commerce giant. It's a blockbuster deal, and what do you make of it?
Yeah, kind of a shocker to me. I mean, Overdrive, as our listeners know, is the leader by a mile in the library e-lending space. And they've also got a number of other distribution businesses involved with them. And I don't think it was any secret that eventually somebody was going to step in and acquire Overdrive. But you know, a lot of speculation was that it was going to be Amazon. Now, I personally never believed that because, frankly, you know, Amazon doesn't want to service the public library market. Amazon wants to be the market. And it isn't like Overdrive's technological solution is super elegant or groundbreaking or anything like that. Amazon has all the same capabilities. So, you know, Overdrive works, and that's, I think, all you need to know about that. I don't think Amazon was ever really in the market for it. But who knows? Maybe they were. But next week, we'll turn to some more questions, and you can read about this on the Publishers Weekly website. We're doing a couple of follow-up reports. And one of the big questions I have is, what does Rakuten, which bought Kobo for $310 million a few years ago, see in Overdrive that they'd spend $410 million in cash? So, you know, Kobo was worth $310. Overdrive is worth $410. And of course, another question we have is, what does this mean for Overdrive's program with the Kindle? You know, speculation is that you know, the books that you could now lend for the Kindle through Overdrive, that now that they're affiliated with Kobo and Rakuten, that agreement with Amazon is going to end. But not necessarily, because that's a fairly popular feature for Overdrive. And if they abandon it, or if Amazon abandons it, I think that's going to be felt by users and would possibly harm the Overdrive product. So lots of questions, and you can read more about this on the PW site next week as we talk to more people and get more information. But suffice it to say, a fairly blockbuster move in the library and ebook world.
Well, indeed, fascinating stuff. And when I read it in the press release, Andrew, I recall that, gee whiz, at the Digital Book World Conference in January, I had as a panel, Michael Tamblyn of Kobo and David Burley of Overdrive. At that point, they were friendly competitors. Now they're actually colleagues.
So hey, they're colleagues for the time being anyway. Yeah,
for the time being, exactly. Well, Andrew Albany, Senior Writer of Publishers Weekly, thanks so much for joining us with the latest news from the book world.
My pleasure, as always.
Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as images, movies, and television shows. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, find us on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at our website, beyondthebook.com. Our engineer and co-producer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.